A founder builds a successful company. When the founder leaves, the company starts to fail. The story that follows, more often than not, is it's too bad the company wasn't strong enough to survive the loss of a great leader. But maybe the story measures greatness incorrectly. Maybe the measurement of greatness isn't about performance during the leader's presence, but how performance endures in the leader's absence. What's the true measurement of leadership, especially in a world that's being transformed as we speak? That's today on The Q Factor. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of The Q Factor. Before we get into today's episode, a quick bit of housekeeping. I've launched a new business called Quent Capital. Quent is a combination of two words that represent lifelong passions of mine and the two ingredients of my new venture, quantitative and entrepreneur. Part of what I'm doing at Quent is quantitatively measuring some of the hidden qualities that make entrepreneurs and the companies they build truly great. Whether it's grit, scrappiness, ingenuity, thriftiness, diversity, or adaptive thinking. I've been fascinated by business leadership and strategy for over 30 years, and I'm continuing this personal journey with every new interview I conduct on The Q Factor. My guest today on The Q Factor is the perfect person to speak to this mission and current moment. Her name is Dr. Frances Fry. She's been a revered professor at the Harvard Business School for over 20 years, and she's also worked with some of the biggest, most innovative entrepreneurial companies in the world on their culture, strategy, and leadership. Along with her brilliant wife and partner, Anne Morris, she's the author of the phenomenal book, Uncommon Service, as well as their highly anticipated follow-up, Unleashed, the unapologetic leader's guide to empowering everyone around you. Their new book comes out in June. Frances is perhaps the world's leading authority on a subject that has become one of the key indicators of a successful business, leadership. I'm proud and grateful to count Frances as an advisor both personally and professionally for over a decade, and continuing now in my work with Quent. The conversation we just recorded couldn't be more relevant or urgent. Ongoing research suggests that strong leadership is a key predictor of a successful business. So how does one use data to identify businesses that have strong leadership characteristics? And how do we maintain and grow a productive culture in our new world of distributed work, a world where we are often thousands of miles apart? Here's our conversation. Frances Fry, welcome to The Q Factor.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Oh, thank you. It's great to have you here, and thank you. So, starting on a personal note, how has your life and work changed in these historic last few months?
Oh, goodness. Everything has changed, I think, is a fair way of saying it, because everyone has changed. Also, everyone that I interact with, we can't take at face value that everything is okay with them. Everybody's got something going on. And so we're learning new ways of taking care of one another. There's also, because of the historic financial situation, that doesn't affect everyone, but for those whom it affects quite dramatically. So I'd say that it affects everything, small e, capital E.
Thinking more globally about this, what are maybe one or two of your big picture observations about how the business world is changing, long-term perhaps, and short-term really, as a result of this historic moment?
Because everyone is going through it at the same time, I think that there's a couple of things going on. Certainly in the business-to-business world, if you are meeting the needs of a client and you are meeting needs 5, 6, or 7, I don't think your business is going to return to normal. That is, I think that we're going to have to figure out how to meet the most important needs of our clients and create a lot of value, and capture some of it, but create a lot of value for it. So I think the luxury of meeting important but not critical needs is going to go away for a couple of years.
I think we're going to come back to that in a different way later, but I know you've always talked with me about how important it is for people and businesses to focus on one or two important things, but now more than ever, that seems to be so critical.
I think now more than ever, yeah.
Well, before we get into the meat of our discussion, you've got a new book coming out, Unleashed, The Unapologetic Leader's Guide to Empowering Everyone Around You. I mean, that's a great title. What's it about?
Yeah, so, and Anne and I wrote it, Anne Morris, yes, my co-author and wife. So it takes the view of leadership that leadership is about making other people better as a result of our presence and then lasting into our absence. So it's a new take on leadership in that it's not about the leader. It's the leader's disposition towards others. And if I can unleash the potential in others and empower other people and create the situation for other people to behave to their capacity, that's when great leadership occurs. So one is it's sort of the reorientation. And then there's a few tools you have in your presence. So it's how do I build a foundation of trust? How do I create the conditions for one person to thrive? And then how do I create the conditions for more and more varied people to thrive? Those are the presence chapters. They're called trust, love, and belonging. And then there's wow. two chapters for the absence. I know those are cool titles. It's cool yeah. chapter titles, aren't they?
Serious. Yeah.
And then for the absence, so, you know, if I lead you in my presence, it's okay for you to be reliant on me. You can come to me with questions. If you're facing a decision, you can check in with me. But if you're really in my absence, you're going to be taking a ton of discretionary action without checking in on me. And then as a leader, I needed to have done two things in order to set you up for success in my absence. I need the strategy to be super clearly communicated in your head so that you know we do this, not that. Here are the trade-offs that we make. And then everywhere where strategy is silent, I need culture to fill in the gaps. I don't get into the debate of which is more important. I know which comes first, which is a clearly articulated strategy is first, and then culture is absolutely everything else.
This concept of measuring the critical qualities of people within organizations that I think we often thought of largely in the past as seeming immeasurable. You know, how do you measure things like leadership, human capital, inspiration? You know, how do you measure these things? How do you measure people and quantifying a company's people? You know, accountants even to this day still think of people as expenses, not assets. How do you think about this within organizations? I know you've worked in quite a few. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. Are people assets or expenses?
Assets, for sure. And should the financial statements change? Yes.
Right.
Now, is it going to take more than you and me declaring that? I think so. And indeed, because the financial statements are as they done as they are, anytime any company hits a problem, the first thing that they want to cut are the variable expense, and that has the appearance of people. It's, of course, a terrible idea long term, but it looks like the only idea short term. That's going to be a real breakthrough, because without doing that, the whole world, it literally, if we write it down as an expense and then we treat it as an expense, that's not surprising. If we wrote it down as an asset and then treated it like an asset, that wouldn't be surprising. It's hard to go cross. So I look forward to a leadership accounting
group. Me too. This idea that to make others better as a result of our presence and having that impact last into our absence. I love that point that you've made in different ways over the years. And I think about it as it relates to myself. As you know, I grew a business as a founder, entrepreneur, Gerstein Fisher, for over 25 years. And I had a great team that you helped me actually with over the years.
Yeah, they were amazing.
And I'm very proud of them all. And now I'm wondering how I'm going to do as a leader now that I'm not there any longer. I guess the success for me would be to see them succeed without me there. And the question is, did I leave behind all the things that were necessary for that to happen? How would I, as an investor, if I stumbled onto a company like Gerstein Fisher or just any company, the founder's not there anymore, how could I potentially find the attributes that I'd be looking for to see that this is a company that's still inspired in the ways that they might have been when the leader was there and that others are now shining? What would I be looking for?
You know, a lot of people, if you look at, like, say that a CEO is in charge of a company and the company rises on their watch and the CEO leaves and the company goes down. And people typically conclude that that person was a good leader because when they were there, it went well. And when they weren't there, it didn't go well. So they must have been the part that was needed. I find that completely wrong. I think if you make things go up in your presence, and then when you leave, it goes down, you are at best a mediocre leader. If success requires you, it's like a hobby business. It can only be what you can directly get your hands over. And if we want to measure things in the long term, and I believe that's what investors want to do, it's terrible to have someone that we know it's going to crumble the moment they leave. And yet we reward those people again and again. So I love that you're looking into this. And one way I would do it is that if things got better on my watch, and then when I left, if things continued to get better, you should look at me far more positively than the person who, when they left, it got worse. But of course, the world gets that precisely wrong.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, you know, think about the leaders whose businesses shined when they left and perhaps follow them around to whatever their next endeavor could be.
They will be creating long-term value for sure.
You know, on the topic of leadership, I think many of us have in our minds what we think of as someone who was a great leader. Do you happen to have anyone in particular that you think of as a great leader or, you know, that made them uniquely effective?
So I look at Microsoft and the CEO of Microsoft. I'd use as the exemplar of leadership today, you know, did a turnaround of Microsoft, a very significant one, did it based on all of the things about presence with the trust, love, and belonging and culture and strategy, did it in a very humble way, in a way that's not about him, but a way that, like, when I say those words, it doesn't mean we're going to lower the standards for performance. It means we're going to thump everyone else. So the company has outperformed itself by doing things much in the way that we talk about. So we met up with the Microsoft story towards the end of our research. And it was amazing to find someone who so closely mirrored what we were talking about. And he, of course, didn't do it alone. He has Kathleen Hogan, who is his head of HR, who has been with him every single step of the way. His senior team is amazing. Peggy Johnson, who is the head of business development. The list goes on. His CFO is amazing. But they are about making others better, and they do some pretty incredible things. If you were only allowed to go study one leader today, I would just go on over to Microsoft.
So just digging a little deeper into this same point of, you know, thinking about founder-driven qualities, at least those that maybe we think of as good, you know, they're not all good. But if we take the position, there is some research that shows, you know, if you own companies on average that have the founder still there, that they do a little better than those that don't have the founder still there. It's a little simplistic, but so there's something about these founders that are considered positive and the qualities of the founders. And I wonder if, is there a way that you might think of that, you know, you might measure these entrepreneurial characteristics in some way? You know, what makes a good entrepreneur and what are those qualities?
So I would say that organizations that are founder-led, that have really, really strong cultures, that almost feel like a cult, are going to outperform. That would be my hypothesis, because you captured the hearts and minds and discretionary effort of everyone in the organization. You would have to have been mission-driven to do it, so that there's some noble purpose. And we've captured the hearts and minds, and that we're going to, in our way, change the world. And it's a really strong culture that is super duper performance oriented. So that, you know, how if you bring in A players, if they like A players and B players bring in C players. So all of a sudden, if you have B players, you might chase away all of the A players because of the C players they'll bring in. Like, you can't, in these strong mission-driven founder-led companies, you don't have any C players. Like, it's like super high performance, high octane. I would say that those companies, I'd say those will outperform their competitors by quite a lot.
This point you made about trust, love, and inclusion as yes. key levers of leadership. And this, you know, I'm going to sort of underline inclusion. But for me, you know, creating an organization that's where, you know, everybody trusts one another, we love and feel for one another, and we're encouraging all people to get involved, all the brains in the game, everybody to contribute, everybody to feel safe in doing that. It's critically important, but probably hard to do. And we were just talking a little bit about diversity or inclusion as a sort of mission critical to company success in the future, probably now more than it's always been important, but I think we all know now that it's more important than ever. You know, I just wonder if you could maybe double click on that and tell us a little bit more, you know, this point about diversity.
Yeah. And so in most organizations, you'll hear about diversity and then they might say diversity and inclusion. And then in today, somebody might say, oh, no, you should have the word equity, or you should, you know, they'll substitute some other words. But the fundamental thing is that diversity alone isn't enough. So I can be a mostly white organization and I can keep bringing in a few Black people and they don't thrive and they leave. And then I bring in other Black people, they don't thrive and they leave. And it's like a treadmill of the diverse folks. So diversity alone doesn't work. But if I am inclusive of the diversity I bring in, that is, if I create the conditions for whomever I bring in to thrive, then it's going to make a big difference. So if I were going to go back in time, I probably would have called it inclusion and diversity, not diversity and inclusion, because you can have diversity and it won't necessarily beget inclusion. But if you have inclusion, I'm pretty sure you're going to attract a lot of diversity. So, and the phrase I like the most is inclusive diversity, because you want to be, and then I want diversity to end up being broad enough that each one of us, like the most interesting thing about each one of us is what's different about us, not what's similar about us. So our human nature to find common ground is precisely what makes things worse. We actually want, you know, we want to find the unique ground and then be with more and more unique people so that we get to do all of that beautiful stuff you do with all your algorithms.
I remember us talking about something very much like this years back. And again, just this one simple thing really changed things for me. But, you know, you think about leaders in, you know, a brainstorming session or a company meeting where they're, you know, dominating the conversation, not really listening, and creating an environment where people are afraid to ask the question or share their opinion if it's different than everyone else. And I think after I'd learned that from you, I worked personally so hard to make sure that I was not like that. Because it does take a little bit of effort for people that are not normally naturally doing that.
Well, I remember watching you change. I can to this day remember the switch you made, which was you used to celebrate people when they, like, you would patiently, instead of speaking first, you would let others speak. But as soon as someone said something that you had already thought, you celebrated them. So you
exactly
celebrated
the wrong idea.
Sameness. No, it was halfway there. And then the switch we made is when you celebrated difference.
Yes.
Is when you celebrated ideas that were different than what you could have come up with. And then that's what then made it safe. Because otherwise everyone was just trying to please you and trying to say what they thought you wanted to hear. And that's, you know, a disaster.
I think often investors look at businesses and when their leadership teams turn over, I think the default position is that that's negative. But I found that particularly when you want to change something within an organization, turnover could be good, that it's actually a positive sign.
Well, listen, in hypergrowth, your leadership team better turn over because you hired someone to be the leader of a 3,000-person organization, and now it's a 20,000-person organization. What's the chance that that leader evolved at the same pace as the organization? Right?
Right.
I mean, zero.
Yep.
So I think in hypergrowth, you better have leadership turnover. Now, those people can stay at the company, but they shouldn't be at the top of the company. They should be layered down. And then that somehow becomes like emotionally hard. So when an organization stays exactly the same, I think that your leadership should stay exactly the same. So it's okay even to have good leaders move on. Again, what matters is, does the organization thrive in their absence?
Such a good point. Yeah, the leadership for businesses at a different time may require different types of leaders at different times.
With certainty, they do. With certainty. This myth that I can bring you through this and that and this, it's just silly.
I remember actually a good friend of both of ours, Professor Boris Groysberg, also at HBS, who I love.
Another magnificent person. If anyone doesn't know him, please know him.
Great guy and a good friend. But I remember him saying something once about how if you want to change something, it's common when you're interviewing someone to come in a senior role in your business, you have a variety of other people meet, make sure everybody feels good about it. But he said something like that, and I hope I'm not quoting him wrong, but something along the lines of there are times where you may not want to do that, where if you want to change something, you may just bring the person in without ever getting everyone's buy-in because they're going to want everything to be the same, not for it all to change. And there are times where you just bring the person in without everybody meeting them. And I thought to myself that that made sense. Probably not all the time, but sometimes.
He's completely right on that. And then I'll also say that, I would watch academic institutions that would make promotion decisions that are largely done by consensus. Like, you have to have enough yeses. You can have a few no's, but you can't have a lot. And I find that that works really well when the majority is voting on the majority. I think that consensus is great. But I think consensus is terrible when we're voting on the minority.
Oh, that's a great point.
And so I think that's probably akin to Boris. And it's one of the things I believe that explains promotion differences is that we're super reliable voting on ourselves. It'd be super interesting to see if the minority can vote for the minority. I've never seen anyone do that. Yeah. Although it makes more sense to me than the majority voting on the minority.
You've very recently worked with a couple of companies that were really right out there with, questions around leadership and some other things. Uber, WeWork, and Riot Games, three great businesses that are all interesting in different ways and have had some struggles as well. I wonder, what were your experiences around those three businesses, Uber, WeWork, and Riot Games, as it relates to some of the conversation we've had around leadership and turnover?
Yeah. So I think that, hypergrowth was, they each experienced their own versions of hypergrowth. Certainly Uber and WeWork, but Riot Games had it as well. And in the situation of hypergrowth, what happens is you bring in people as individual contributors, and 5 minutes later, you make them managers. And 5 minutes after that, they're managers of managers. But you couldn't possibly have kept up with, if management and leadership are skills, you haven't prepared them. So the organizations will, by design, go into some sort of org debt unless you are investing as much in the people as you are in the technology. And this could go back to the beginning of our conversation. And so what I found in each of the organizations is that filled with really good people, but with some pretty severe org debt. So the good news is that's easy to identify and relatively easy to solve. It was a little trickier solving it at Uber, which was, globally distributed for 15,000 people, but we figured out how to do it in a way that was really high quality. So I think that that's the one thing, is that you'll find the org debt with hypergrowth. The other thing is that in all three of those cases, and I think it's probably true in others, that the founders will set the original culture. Like you did at Gerstein Fisher, it's one of the awesome things about being a founder is you get to say, look, this is the culture I want. I remember Tony Hsieh said he started Zappos in large part because he hated working at the other company he started. So he was like, for darn sure, going to create a great culture.
That is a really fun part of being an entrepreneur and a founder. Like, at least for some time, like, you don't have to answer to anybody. It changes quickly, but you know, at the beginning.
It does change quickly, but in the beginning, you get to do that. Well, what happens in all cultures, the cultural values, particularly the more specifically they're stated, and I find founder-led companies take a lot of pride in crafting their values, and they'll be, you know, 3 or 7 or 10, and they'll be a sentence or a half sentence and then a paragraph description, but there's like art and poetry in it. And I love it. But what will happen is the beautiful intention behind all of that will end up getting weaponized without the founder realizing it. And then when the founder does hear of it, they're likely to dismiss it as, well, those people just don't understand the values. That's not what the values meant. So we just have to re-educate people. But the truth is, the second of cultural value gets weaponized, you got to get rid of it. Otherwise, it creates a really toxic environment. So let me give you an example.
Must be hard to do.
No, it's actually quite easy, the key is the founder shouldn't do it. The company should do it. That's when you let the company come up with round two of the cultural values.
Makes sense.
Then you democratize it. So founder can do version one, but founder should definitely not do version two.
Huh. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so that's the punchline. Travis at Uber very famously, I loved his original cultural values, like loved them. They were 14. He had a really beautiful document written about it. It was like one of the best organizational documents I've ever read, because the intention, they were mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive, brought out the best in one another. They were beautiful.
So this was all like a documented set of ideas, basically.
Yeah. And so like one of them was toe-stepping. And what it meant is, if you're junior in an organization, if your manager is stifling your good idea, step on your manager's toes and go to the person above them. Don't you love it? Isn't it beautiful?
Oh, I love that.
That cultural value got very famously weaponized.
Huh.
Because instead of being as the original intent, which is beautiful, instead people started interpreting it as, we can step on one another's toes. In fact, we can step on people's toes that are more junior to us. And so it became a very license for an aggressive shorthand, I'm going to step on your toes. So the vast majority of the toe stepping was not going on up. It was going on down. Hmm. Now, the thing I watched with Travis early on is there were a few of his values got weaponized, as I have seen at every single founder-led company. And Travis, like other founders, wanted everyone to participate in the re-education and was very slow to believe that sometimes when popular culture makes your cultural value, your beautiful cultural value, weaponized, you got to start again. And that is a beautiful moment, because then you involve everyone in the organization doing it. And then the cultural values have an even more importance now. And I think that exercise should go on every, you know, at least every 5 years for an organization.
Another set of ideas that I know you've been really passionate about is strategy and client service. In many ways, all these things are around how you treat people and, you know, how you honor them and cherish them and take care of them, whether it's your customers or your employees or just the people around you. You talk about these companies' obsessions around customer service, which is another attribute that I look for when I'm investing in businesses. And certainly I've always tried my best to do a good job in my own business around that. Could you give an example of, you know, maybe one or two companies that in your mind just really like killed it in a good way on customer service and how that benefited the business and their customers?
Sure. You know, and there are the, you know, there's the like, I outperform you on customer service, or I like disrupt the whole industry on customer service. So I think that, you know, Uber disrupted the taxi industry because nobody enjoyed the taxi experience. Nobody. It was like not any part of it. And then Uber was better on every dimension. Uber competing against taxis is very different than Uber competing against Lyft. So if I look at it that way, like who has distinguished themselves on service? I mean, a company that I love is a company called PillPack. It was an independent company. Mm. And I think there was a bidding war between Walmart and Amazon. And I believe Amazon won.
Right.
The idea was that instead of going to the pharmacy to get your prescription filled, and you have to go, if you know you have five different prescriptions, they're not all on the same cycle, and you know, it just, instead of doing that, they mail you a month worth of prescriptions in a daily pouch, and you just open the pouch and take them. Their breakthrough, though, was you could do it for prescription and non-prescription. So if you have vitamin D and you have heart medicine, and your doctor could curate all of it, and then it would get sent to you. So the compliance goes through the roof on all of it. And it's also, your doctor knows what you're taking, because usually when we're taking our multivitamins, our doctor doesn't know. So it made it better for everyone. And here's the thing, they don't charge a penny extra. They just, because they don't have to have the physical drug stores, their cost savings is so much more. So it's like everyone is better off. The doctor feels like they're delivering better medicine. The patient is delivering better medicine. I mean, it's just a dream sequence of a service that went after a really big pain point, which is our compliance with medicine is really low for a bunch of reasons, one of which is we haven't made it to the pharmacy to refill our prescriptions or to get the new batch of multivitamins. So I love them and have loved them for a long time.
We were together a little more than 10 years ago. We talked about this briefly. It was a highlight in my career. You, myself, and we were together with Jack Bogle, the founder of Vanguard.
Yes.
Which was amazing. Passed away not too long ago, unfortunately. And David Booth from the University of Chicago and Dimensional Funds. And I don't know if you remember what our actual topic was, but this was shortly after the financial crisis was going on. We were sort of heading into what we all hoped was some kind of recovery. I think it was 2010-11. Things hadn't really improved 100% yet. We were talking about how the way that we were going to grow our way out of that mess was through innovation. I asked you specifically to talk with us all because we were a service economy. And we needed to think about ways to, you know, innovate and operationalize service. I remembered you talking to us all about how in order for businesses to have a strategy that works and for them to be, you know, great at something, they needed to be proud of what they, I think you might say, suck at.
Yeah, I certainly would.
Like before you can be great at anything, you have to first really work very hard to be proud of what you're going to be bad at. What are some businesses that you can think of that went through that exercise of what are they going to be bad at before they decided what they were going to be great at?
Yeah, so I think the classic example for that is Southwest Airlines. So Southwest Airlines is, you know, for sure the airline you would have wanted to invest in. But customers love it. Employees love it. Investors love it. Like it's, you know, it unlike other airlines, it makes money every quarter, every year. It's just been soundly successful. Well, they're unapologetically good at a few things, and they are able to be good at those things like point-to-point flights and short turnarounds. And they're a short turnaround airline. They're a quick turnaround airline that allows them to have a lower cost structure. But because of that, they can't do things. So you couldn't get a seat assignment at Southwest. So they're deliberately bad at seat assignments, which every other airline was good at, so that they could have faster turnaround time.
I remember the first time I flew that airline, I had a good experience, but I remember exactly that. I was like, you know, how's this working? I didn't understand. You know, people are calling
and
me.
But here's what they found out, that as long as the load on the plane is less than 90%, you can board faster with no seat assignments.
That's great.
And the reason they wanted you to board faster is because if they could board planes 30 minutes faster than their competitors, they could get like an extra trip out of every plane a day. And it saved them after you looked at the cost of capital and things, about $320 million a year, which was about their annual profit. So they were optimized to be really great at some things and were unapologetically bad at others. In fact, every once in a while, people would come in with awesome ideas. Oh, our customers complained and they would really like to have seat assignments. And you can imagine an empathetic person saying, oh my gosh, well, our really frequent flyers are complaining. We got to listen to them. And then the whole business would unravel without knowing it. So in order to be great, you have to be bad. You have to be equally unapologetic about both. And you really have to understand the hard-coded trade-offs. When we met, it wasn't that long after the interaction that I had with Steve Jobs, which when I went to Apple to describe these concepts, was right around the time of the MacBook Air. And how he described it is that when he made the MacBook Air, the first one, it was best in class at weight, and precisely because it was worst in class at physical features. At the time, I think it was like an internal CD-ROM or something like that.
Right.
And he said they could have been best in class at physical features, but then they would have had to have been worst in class at weight. And so it understanding like that engineering schematic trade-off to your business, like understanding your business so well that you can see the equivalent of the contractor's triangle of cost, quality, speed, pick two. Like if you think you can get better at everything, here's what I know. You're off the frontier. And so the whole thing, the only way to unravel it is to pick what you're going to be great at and then reverse engineer. What does it mean you have to be bad at in order to be of service to that? And that is the main thing we talk about in Uncommon Service. And that I still have not found a counterexample to that anywhere in the world.
Yeah. And actually, on that point, I think that shows up in some investment research in some strange ways, too. Just this idea of finding businesses, you know, small growing businesses that have a clearly defined strategy.
Yeah.
And maybe one of the things to look for is that they're not doing too many different things. But you also find this too in like when companies start buying things, like when they're buying growth versus building it organically, I think that we've seen this in the data that as companies buy lots of things and start doing too many things, they tend to underperform.
Yeah, and I'm so delighted to hear that because I have so much less respect for buying companies and then saying, oh, look, we're three times as big. Versus growing a company
Absolutely.
Organically to three times as big. But I find the CEOs that buy, not only do they have like the self-ego, but they get rewarded. Oh, you brought us from a $5 billion company to a $15 billion company. Yeah, because you brought two $10 billion companies and destroyed some of the value.
Exactly. Like, you know, it does come back to those accountants again, because, you know, when you buy a business and all the people that come with it, you get to take the goodwill and put it on your financial statement, you know, sort of amortize it as an asset. It's not an expense.
Golly, if you're allowed to do that, couldn't we please put the employees as
tell
assets?
Tell me about it. It's not fair, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense. So
we're just waiting. Accountants, academic accountants out there, I have your research topic.
Exactly. So a couple last points around the current environment and some of the things we're talking about. You know, I have the new business that I've started recently, Quent Capital. I have a small team, about five of us now. We're all just getting to know one another. Thank you. I'm having fun. It's fun building a business again and being an entrepreneur again, although I miss all my friends at Gerstein Fisher. As I'm doing this, you know, we're a new team, just getting to know one another, you know, forming and storming. And now all of a sudden, we're all working from remote locations. We're not together. We're, you know, Teamsing and Skyping and Zooming and all that stuff. There are some challenges around, you know, creating that trusting, loving, safe environment, getting to know one another, all the things we've been talking about. And I just wonder if you've started thinking about in this new world we're now living in and may continue to live in some way, you know, how do you do all this stuff when you're working Yeah. from the basement of your home?
So I'll tell you some things, but really what you should just do is remember the name Sadal Mealy and go
Will
and
do.
Look to anything she says and writes. But essentially, so a couple of things. One is that if you had the team before and you now have them, but you're now working remotely, there's a couple of things we know. One is that if you used to have weekly one-on-ones, you should have them twice a week. If you used to have them twice a week, you should have them four times a week. So that when you're remote, you need to double the frequency of interactions. You should also shorten the duration of interactions. So while you might have been able to tolerate a 90-minute meeting in person, it's super hard to do it on Zoom. So you want to do more frequent, shorter duration. And the more frequent is because a lot of informal development occurs not in formal meetings. But since you don't have a chance for informal development, there's no water coolers, there's no having lunch together, you have to create more opportunities so that that informal development that can occur. So that's why you need to do it more often. And some of the agendas you need to just be really open so that you can have conversations like we're having. Because I watch you, Greg, some of the greatest development you did with people was not on the scheduled part, but it was, you know, opportunistically taking advantage of a moment with someone.
Absolutely.
So you have to be much more deliberate about that over this. So give yourself twice as many bites at the apple in a week and learn how to be more efficient in meetings so that your meetings are, you know, three quarters to half as long. So that's the first thing. And the second one is that everybody now has a context. Everybody. Inquiring about the context is a really gracious, generous thing to do. So certainly as the leader, you should be checking in with people and allowing there to be space, really creating the conditions so that people can talk about their context is important right now, but it's super necessary to do. And then the other thing I would say is that, you know, every time you add a new person to your team, you should update the team dynamics. It's a chance to reconvene for the best version of ourselves. Anytime someone from a team leaves, it's a chance for us to update our team dynamics so that the best version of ourselves shows up. Well, anytime you go through a crisis and you change completely the way we interact, it's a chance to update the team dynamics. So I would check in with people for a conversation about what's working about Zoom, what's not, what are small things we can do that could make it a lot better? What are big things we can do that can make it a lot better? And I would make it totally discussable. And here's why. Two reasons you might come up with good ideas. And two, people don't have to just constantly in the real in their own head keep saying, I would change this, I would change this, I would change this. Like once they get to articulate it, they get to let it go.
That's great. These things seem so simple when we talk about them, you know, like if you're doing it once a week, do it twice a week, you know, that do it short, do it frequent, but just doing
it. If somebody didn't give you the secret memo, you didn't know to do it. It's like Right. Everything else. I grew up and was super curious as an adult why I wasn't given the secret memos for so many obvious things. I feel like it's my right, like my way to pay that forward is anytime I learn something, I try to put it in secret memo form.
I love it. I want to give everyone a little bit of a better understanding of how we can learn more from you around these Ooh. Ideas. And I know earlier I mentioned your and Anne's new book, Unleashed.
Yeah. I do everything of importance I do with Anne.
I love it. Well, how do we buy it? You know, like obviously, yeah. But like that, let's just start with that. Like, how do we buy this book?
Yeah. So I love that question and it's kind of you. And here's how you could do me a favor if you bought it, but just buy one copy because the more zip codes it's purchased from, the better. And if you buy 10 copies or one copy, it's not that different to me in the beginning because the reason I need books to be sold is so that the booksellers will restock it. So if not very many copies get sold before it comes out, which is on June 2nd, it can go out of stock pretty quickly. So you can also just give me a call or give Greg a call.
Beautiful. Yeah, please do. And I know I have my book coming and I encourage everyone listening, not only because I love Frances and want to help her, but actually you'd be helping yourself. Her materials have been enormously helpful to me. So I encourage everyone to check it out. We have three final quick questions that I ask all my guests.
Yeah, great.
And I'm wondering if you'd just react to them.
I sure will.
And we call them the three Qs. You know, I ask everybody this, no matter what their background or expertise. And here's the first one, you know, beyond economics and business, where do you see big data having the biggest positive impact on the world
healthcare
over the next 10 years? Yeah, that's great.
Healthcare. No question.
Yeah. And clearly we know we need that right now.
No. And it's the like interaction of pharmacies with the uniqueness of ourselves. Like we're all very different and healthcare has been acting as if we're all the same. Big data is the only solution to that.
Absolutely. Well, the second question, and on the flip side, you know, what aspect of the world do you see as being the most threatened by big data over the next 10 years?
Personal privacy. So I get very, very nervous about how good the data sweepers are on all of the platforms and all our interactions. Like, I think we can be completely known through sources of data and aggregating those sources of data. And I don't like that.
Tell me about it. I mentioned to my wife earlier that I was looking to lose some weight, and like 30 seconds later, I got an advertisement for some weight loss thing. And
it's
thinking,
terrifying. I really feel like they're just going to start listening to our thoughts.
Totally. Well, last question, artificial intelligence. Is it a friend or is it a foe?
It's done correctly. It's a dear, dear friend. And if you have any questions about it, read the book just put out by Kareem Lakhani and Marco Iancidi, and it will tell you every single thing you need to know about it and how to make it a friend, not a foe.
Great. Well, again, Francis Fry, thank you so much for joining us on the Q Factor, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you again real soon.
This was such a pleasure. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Dr. Francis Fry. If you liked our show today, please give us a good rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll have another fascinating guest on our next episode of The Q Factor. I'm Greg Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Greg Fisher is founder and portfolio manager of Quent Capital, a registered investment advisor. Economic and market views and forecasts stated by Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital are current as of the date of this podcast and are subject to change without notice. This presentation is not intended to be a solicitation of any kind. It is for general informational purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results. The views of the guests that appear on the Q Factor are their own and may not reflect the views of Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital.